Box to Box Stoppage Time.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Great savings every day.
And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices.
Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Hello and welcome to Box Stoppage Time. You're with Rob Gilbert, Michael Edgley and Derek Dyson for our podcast where we range through the highlights of our past week, our teams and moments of the week and plenty more. Gentlemen, I'm not even going to let you guys get started because I plucked this one off the top shelf. There had to be someone who picked the game of the week and I chose this one.
Moments. Adeyemi. He's around Courtois. Has been put behind for a corner kick. Fulkrug off the post and out, and still they can't find the net. Another huge let off for Real Madrid. Adeyemi now kept out by Courtois. Sabitza worth a try and forcing the save out of Courtois. Adeyemi, Politano, and turned away by Courtois. In by Kroos. And Real Madrid have gone in front. Dani Carvajal, the breakthrough at last. Second best for much of this final. But Real Madrid are now in front, headed in front by Dani Carvajal. Oh, it's been given away by Madsen. This surely will wrap it up. Vinicius Jr. pounces. It's a gift for Vinicius Jr. Borussia Dortmund's hard work comes to nothing. It's their trophy again. It's Real Madrid's trophy again.
Now, I know that one-minute clip was slightly indulgent, but I didn't think I counted anything less. And they weren't the only golden opportunities that Borussia Dortmund had in the first half to get on the scoreboard, but they couldn't do it. They eventually ended up not being the irresistible force, but they were certainly playing the immovable object, of course, Real Madrid. They won the first five Champions League titles under various European Cup titles and names, as it was known back then. They've won it 15 times. They are one of the great international clubs of football, but to continually be serial winners the way that they are, it just defies description. And Edge, I mean, you travel the world. I guess a question I'd ask is, is it an Australian thing that we think of the English clubs as the biggest clubs in world football, or am I looking at this through an Anglo lens? And if I was to walk the streets of Brazil, various other countries in South America, am I going to see as many Real Madrid, obviously in Spain, in Madrid, white jumpers?
Rob, it's very clear the English-speaking world thinks the English football, you know, the Premier League is the best in the world, and the Spanish-speaking world thinks it's La Liga. So, you know, it is really split down that path, and you can see it here in Los Angeles. I was walking around today at lunchtime and saw some Real Madrid shirts in the street. Some Mexicans wearing Real Madrid shirts, obviously celebrating the fact that they got the job done. So it is. I mean, in Australia, we do have a predominant sort of focus on the Premier League, but not in other parts of the world.
Okay. All right. Well, we could indulge ourselves. We've talked a lot about the Champions League final, but we do have a schedule to keep going. So why don't you roll into your game of the week, mate?
My game of the week was at the moment, the European qualifiers for women are on, and England's got themselves in a bit of strife here. They were defeated by France by 2-1, and they're in a really tough group with Sweden and Ireland. The way the group stands at the moment, France, after three matches, France have 9 points. Sweden and England both have 4 points. Sweden's in second spot, top two go through. So, yeah, it's a big issue for England. They actually got to play France again away from home. This match they lost was at home. Beth Mead put them ahead at the 31st minute, but France made 2 goals, one before halftime, one after halftime.
So, Edge, that game, you know, again, we talk about the vagaries of podcasting, is likely to have been played by the time many of our listeners get the chance to tune in. So even if England win that game, which is, as you said, in France, they're still not out of the woods.
Oh, no, that's right. And if they lose the game, they're in all sorts of trouble because, you know, Sweden has the softer run home. And it'll all come down to the final match between Sweden and England, I would think, in Sweden. So England's got its work cut out. It needs to win every game, basically.
And who...
Imagine England. They missed the Olympic Games, and they could miss the Euros.
Their own Euro defence, Derek. Serena Wiegmann travelling to her home country. What a game that'd be.
Yeah, my first reaction to that is, geez, how hard is the group? England, yeah, the group's France, hard, but, and yeah. Sweden. Yeah, I mean, when England men are, they're playing, with all due respect, they're not playing teams of that calibre. Like, that's a group of death, isn't it? How did that happen, Edge?
Yeah, well, it's part of the new. It's got three tiers. So, two teams from each of the groups in tier one qualify, and in tier two and three, only one, the top team from each of the group, go through. So there is a better chance for qualification. But if in that top tier, if you go through the groups, the group one is Netherlands, Norway, Italy, and Finland. Group two is Spain, Denmark, Belgium, Czechia. Then it's France, Sweden, England, and Republic of Ireland. And the last group in the top tier is Germany, Austria, Iceland, and Poland. So you're right, England is in the toughest group, no doubt about it.
Watch this space. All right, we will watch it. Derek, what's your game of the week, mate?
I'm doing qualifying two. I don't have a indulgent one-minute package of Poland women versus Israel women. It might have been a damp squib because there was no one there watching this game. Shades of COVID, and I can hear one Michael Edgley. These words screaming in my ears that you should never mix politics and sport. Well, it wasn't the Scotland or Israeli women's fault that this game was delayed and played in front of nobody, but there were concerns about pro-Palestinian protests before the game. Some people, fair dinkum, they managed to get into the ground and attach themselves to the goal frame, and that held up the game for half an hour or so, and then they got Scotland's women let the football do the talking, 1-4-1 over Israel. This was Scotland. They've got a Spanish manager called Pedro Martinez Losa, and one of the other great tragedies was he was wearing a dark blue suit and tie, but with white trainers. It was awful from him, but it wasn't awful for Scotland, who looked a couple of classes above their Israeli counterparts. They were comfortable going into half time, and goal scoring has been a bit of a problem for Scotland. There were 7 goals in the last 10 games for Scotland, so a lack of firepower seemingly, but Thomas and Hansen were both return to this side and put in a really good first half display and put the Scots comfortably 4-0 up before Israel got their consolation. So that means Scotland have taken 7 points from their opening 3 games. They're top of Group 2 on goal difference, with Serbia second after beating Slovakia. That would have been a tasty game as well.
And who says we don't cover all the games in football? And I would have listened to your one-minute package if you had have chosen to prepare for it, Derek, but you didn't. Anyway, moving right along now, I am going to nominate my team of the week, and it will come to fruition as to why I'm choosing the US national women's team, because it was Emma Hayes first as the new head coach of that side.
I felt for the first 30 minutes... it was technical execution where we struggled. We scored in our first 3 chances, so we were efficient, we were clinical, we were controlled from there on in. Second half, players coming in, added value, and all round, like, I'm really happy with the first performance, and it's just, you know, one step in the right direction.
Well, you would be. They beat South Korea 4-0, who are not a walkover under any set of circumstances in the women's or the men's game. She said, I think you can see something building here. There's a lot of work to do, a lot of holes in our play, no question, but it was a good start. So when you've got a new manager coming into the US national women's team, Edge, describing the setup
with an accent like that.
Exactly, that way. They play South Korea again in coming days, but they're preparing for the ominously Paris Olympics, of which we are going to be playing in their group, Michael. So I'm just a little bit worried that even though there's not much time to prepare, if there's anyone who can prepare a squad to be tournament ready, even though she comes from clubland, surely it's got to be Emma Hayes.
Don't forget the entire football community in the United States, which, you know, has a similar sort of reverence to the US women's national team like we do to the Matildas. They are, the players in that team are smarting because they had such a poor performance at the World Cup. So they are going to be fired up to do well at the Olympic Games. They love the Olympic format, the Yanks. We've got them in our group. I guess to be the best, you've got to beat the best. But it's going to be a fascinating, fascinating Olympic women's football tournament. It, I actually think it'll be one of the major features of the entire Olympic Games.
Hang on. Aren't you the bloke that said we shouldn't take Olympic football seriously? You said drinking the Kool-Aid.
No. I said that the women's football Olympic tournament is, it shouldn't be rated as highly as it is because Europe only get three spots of the 12 at the event, which means that five of the top 10 teams in the world don't go. So that's just a fact, Rob.
You can't get excited
about the Aussies fighting.
I know I'm excited, but I'm just going to go to the official box-to-box archivist and double-check exactly what you did say. But I'll tell you, Derek and I were at the last game at Amy Park when they got beaten by Sweden. I mean, look, that was one of the, like, of the many highlights of the World Cup, Derek.
Unhappy camp, Derek, didn't they, the Yanks?
Oh, they certainly did. And it seemed to me, I mean, Megan Rapinoe has given so much to the game generally, not just US women's soccer, but there seemed to be a kind of something around her, you know, like it was her, you know, potentially her last game. And, you know, she came on and tried to change the game and couldn't. But yeah, they looked kind of dysfunctional and, you know, wasn't what I thought I was going to see on the night, that's for sure.
Famously missed the penalty in the shootout. Your team of the week, Derek?
Yeah, so and we all know that Australia and Melbourne in particular has a large and passionate football-loving Greek community. I can imagine there are a few places in South Melbourne going absolutely bonkers when Olympiakos became the first Greek side to win a European trophy. Before I talk about the game, Edge, I'll bring you in as our expert on this. Can you set the scene of what some of those bars and coffee shops would have been like in the early hours of the morning as this game was unfolding?
Yes, the some certain establishments in Albert Park and South Melbourne. But what about High Street, Thornbury? It was just packed full of Olympiakos fans, and they well and truly celebrated, didn't they? Greek football is one of those anomalies where, you know, it's one of those leagues where you've got Panathinaikos and Olympiakos and AEK and PAOK, four sort of teams, but it always seems to be the red and white stripes or the green in Athens that get the job done. So, but they just don't perform on the continental stage, but they have this time. And what about the scenes? Derek, explain this. Just paint the picture of the scenes, because the celebrations were epic.
Well, yeah, look, inside the ground, I mean, again, a bit like the game we spoke about last week between Atalanta in Dublin, and of course they beat Leverkusen. I mean, that was incredible. And then you had you had Olympiakos and Fiorentina fans at it this time. I mean, just so much passion in one stadium. And yeah, when that goal went in from Ayub Al-Kabi with 4 minutes left of extra time, the stadium and the Olympiakos fans behind the goal went absolutely berserk. Of course, he was the hero of the run to the final. But yeah, he got a header from Santiago Heze's cross. They did have to do a very lengthy VAR check, of course, which just added to the drama. But that was 11th goal in the competition, no less. And now he's written his place into Greek footballing history. So unlucky for Fiorentina after their counterparts Atalanta got the business done the week before. But I think overall, these, particularly the Europa League and the Europa Conference League, keep delivering these brilliant narratives. And it is just good to see teams not out of the usual suspects winning these tournaments.
And Rob, there is a breaking news alert that the manufacturers of flares in China, there's a special shipment going down to Greece because every single orange flare that was or red flare that was available for purchase in Greece was purchased by the Olympiacos fans who've spent the next 3 days after that victory. Just letting the flares off in the centre of Athens. So
yeah, no, I do follow the Associated Press news feed, and there was a report from NASA that that there was a red highlight somewhere over Greece. But poor old Fiorentina losing back to back. But that game was it was a bit of a snore fest for the non-partisan fan, but it's the classic football scenario where it doesn't matter how tight a match is. The stakes were so high that at different stages, I think I heard one of the commentators saying that both sides were scared to win it. But win it, they did, Olympiacos. Well done to them. Now, Edge, I love the reason why you've chosen your team of the week. We haven't really talked much about the AC Milan-Roma match, and Derek as well. I was going to text you to check if you were watching it that night, and you know, classic case of fixturing at times. That game was on at the same time as the Matildas' first match was, and Olivier Giroud playing his last ever match for the Rossonero. But Edge, you chose that game of the week for a different reason.
Yeah, it's my team of the week, AC Milan. I mean, they participated in that seven goals in the exhibition game. There was a couple of beautiful goals in that game, but it's got nothing to do with the football. I just wanted to highlight what AC Milan, its foundation, did. When it was agreed that AC Milan would come out, they chose a charity in Perth, the Perth Blind Football, and they mandated within the playing group and within the club and with the promoters and the people involved in staging the event that every single piece of official merchandise and some very special experiences back at the San Siro would go into all of the functions and be promoted to support the Perth Blind Football. So the foundation, the AC Milan Foundation, is very active. They've got projects in over 20 countries around the world with the diaspora of AC Milan fans, and it's still ongoing, but I believe that they've contributed to over $150,000 already to this Perth Blind Football, and the impact of that money and the shining the spotlight on the fantastic work they do in providing access to football for blind people. I just thought AC Milan, well done, highly organised, didn't cost them, they did not put in the money in themselves, but effectively coordinating their assets and imprint on that activity to ensure that they could leave a legacy. And I just thought it was worthy of recognition, Rob.
Yeah, no, great. Well said, Edge. You know, we give a shout out as often as we possibly can to any support for disability football that we possibly can. I'll said it many times, my son Alexander lives with cerebral palsy, and the Australian cerebral palsy men's and women's team are just such a great example of showing fairness, equality and diversity in football and blind football for those of our vision challenged brothers and sisters is a wonderful thing. And when you get a club like AC Milan of its stature throwing its weight and finances behind it, that can only be a good thing. All right. So as we move along our hot topics, look, Edge, we did briefly talk to Martin Tyler about this in the main show earlier in the week, but just jaw-dropping scenes. And I don't think we should give the people who orchestrated the pitch invasion any more publicity than they've already got. But it was a farce. There was no better word to describe it.
I'm just extremely disappointed, considering the trouble that Wembley had in the Euro final, and then a couple of years back, and we've covered that extensively. All of the people that got their way into the stadium, and then we had this situation where it sounds like they've done a reasonable. 53 people were arrested. At the game, most of those people trying to get into the stadium without tickets. But inside the stadium, they didn't think about securing the pitch very well, did they, Rob? Because they had three pitch invaders. They actually had a fourth that they did stop. But fair dinkum, imagine employing someone like me to be on the pitch in your civvies and your dress shoes, trying to run across the pitch and tackle a pitch invader. Surely there's a professional security outfit who can ring the pitch side and stop people from jumping the fence. It was amateur hour stuff. Hugely embarrassing for Wembley. Again, destroyed the reputation of major event staging in England. And quite seriously, I mean, I know that these people were promoting some social media influence. We won't say who it is. We won't give them any more oxygen. But, I mean, they're running up next to players and taking selfies. I mean, imagine if they had a knife, Rob.
Oh, it's just disgraceful, and tragically, and I hate to forecast this, but one day it's going to happen. Something like that is going to happen, and then we'll all look back and say, how many times were we warned that this could happen? Forget about the optics of it. If someone runs out onto the pitch, I don't care how big and burly the security guards are there. They get out there and they do whatever's required to get them off the pitch.
Well, I mean, in most other parts of the world, you know, if you go to a FIFA World Cup, and both the men's and women's, there's about 9 or 10 guys in incredibly athletic guys in their football boots and tracksuits, ready for this exact situation, and they can pounce on the intruder before they actually get anywhere. But Wembley obviously has no idea. I mean, who was? It's just unfathomable that an event of this size and magnitude that people could get onto the field of play. Give me a break.
No. It's like you had one job. You had one job. All right, we'll continually watch that. All right, Derek, moving along, your hot topic, the Tinker Man.
Yeah, so this went under the radar a little bit for me. It's a couple of weeks old, this news now, but it is the news that Claudio Ranieri is retiring from football management. Leaving all tribalism aside, there aren't too many football fans who aren't charmed by the bespectacled Italian. I think everywhere he went, he left an amazing impression on people, whether you supported the club or not. Now, I do remember, Rob, that there was one famous banner at the King Power Stadium in Leicester's time of Ranieri recreating a famous film pose. Can you remember what that banner was?
Oh, look, I'm sure it was something to do with The Godfather. And, it was, the Don sitting at his desk in the opening scene of The Godfather 1 when the wedding scene is about to take place? And, buonasera, buonasera, buonasera. What have I done to treat me with such disrespect?
It's quite right. Yeah, it is The Godfather. So I'm bringing back the movie references in Stoppage Time. And I've decided to go for the nuclear option, which I think is one of your favourite films of all time. Yes. And Ranieri has been referred to as The Godfather, as most elderly Italian men tend to be. He was 72 years old when he retired. Took charge of 18 sides in club land, a brief stint as the Grease boss as well, a four-decade career that started back in 1986. He managed the likes of Chelsea, AS Roma, Juventus, Parma, even Atletico Madrid. And you mentioned it off the top, he was known as the Tinker Man, which I think was a pejorative moniker as opposed to a compliment. But he was a tactical genius, a man of class, and a very very honourable person. I suspect that Don Corleone would have liked receiving Ranieri, and I'm sure Ranieri wouldn't have insulted him in that engagement. But look, I remember him from when he burst onto the scene at Chelsea. It was the first part of Roman Abramovich's revolution at Chelsea. He was, of course, ditched for a young, promising Portuguese manager called Jose Mourinho, who we've spoken about a little earlier. But, of course, the most famous thing that he did in our world was leading Leicester to that 2015-16 Premier League title, 5,000-1. But it was fitting that he ended at Calgary, the club that he started. He lost his last game 3-2, but he did save them from relegation in Sardinia, and there were tears on the pitch as he left. So all I can say is complimenti e arrivederci, Signor Ranieri. We will never see your like again. And Rob, you must note that I did actually watch The Godfather for the first time over the weekend.
I didn't know you'd never seen it. Wow, you did. Well, this is a whole other conversation. Now, Edge is giving us his little fingers. He wants to ask one little one. But before I let you speak, I am going to say something, because obviously this is my sweet spot when you play the Sweet Softly Love theme of Nina Rota, which was infamously withdrawn from the running for the best original dramatic score in the 45th Academy Awards, because there was part of the soundtrack that was used in another film once before. But now, beautifully said, and Adam continues to roll it underneath. I think we might introduce this as our new theme song, Michael. So what have you got to say? You wanted to add something little. What is it?
Well, I just thought it was outstanding that Derek got The Godfather in there, because those supersonic hearing, our guests that have supersonic hearing that have listened to our shows over the years would know that Rob Gilbert can recite every single word of the Godfather trilogy. You name it, you throw a scene at him, and Rob Gilbert will be able to let you know exactly the script. He's the world's greatest Godfather fan, and it's just fitting that Derek, you were able to just bring a smile to Rob's face.
You did,
and it did. The Godfather.
And like, you're making me sound like the Bruce McAvaney of The Godfather, but I do can see that as a pop culture reference, there is none that I hold more dear than that one. And I remember my Italian father-in-law, Luigi, he'd never watched it before because, you know, he didn't quite feel comfortable watching a trilogy of films made about crime in his native land. But one day I said, Luigi, please, I've got to go to work today. These are the three DVDs. I just want you to put it on. If you hate it, turn it off. I came back at the end of the day as he was watching the end of The Godfather 3, and he's gone to God now, but he loved it. And to my dear departed father-in-law Luigi and all the great people of that wonderful country of Italy, and to Francis Ford Coppola and Al Ruddy, the producer of The Godfather, died at the age of 94. Now, I'm going to ask you one. I know I said we got to keep this time. You know what Al Ruddy was almost also famous for before The Godfather, for producing? He was brought in the show to by the producers of Paramount to bring the film in under budget. He was brought in because he'd done a TV show, which was a period TV show, and he was famously under budget, and it was Hogan's Heroes. Al Ruddy, producer of The Godfather. And that is a true story. Check it out. Okay, I'm going to move on to my hot topic. Adam doesn't have to play The Godfather theme underneath it. I just sort of almost feel like you just took the words right out of my mouth. I think we need to get John Stensolt on it. John, if you're listening, please come on. We want to talk about the $200 million TV broadcast deal, which is going to just break all records. Ed, you talked about it already in the main show about the coffers of Football Australia swelling right now, but it's a great thing. So we'll get John Stensolt on to talk about it soon. At length. So that's my very brief hot topic, because you know, how could I possibly beat Derek's effort? Thank you, my friend. You know, I have to watch The Godfather 2, which is, if not better, it is at the very least the equal to The Godfather 1. Just got to watch it, and then get the book too. I mean, just read it till it falls apart like I have. All right, Michael, as you're tittering there, thanks again. Do well in LA. Prepare for us all, mate, because I think you're going to get a crew of the box-to-box loyal listeners and maybe one or two of us.
It's 3:35 a.m. here. Goodbye and good night.
Okay. No, well, let's, I think it sounds like a famous English comedian who I can't quite recall his name. Derek, thank you.
Thanks, Robin. I hope your lamb shank isn't burnt.
Oh, no, it's just on a light little simmer. And to Adam Maloney, thank you as well, my friend, for making sure the show came together so beautifully. And I might take a nice slow moment to reflect over the great score of Nina Rota, the love scene of The Godfather. If you haven't watched it, I can't believe Derek hadn't watched it till this past week. As Molly Meldrum would say, do yourself a favour, get the trilogy. The number three isn't as bad as people say. In fact, it's quite a good movie. But before then, make sure you subscribe to Box Stoppage Time and Offside, wherever you get your podcasts. Tweet us at Box to Box NTS and follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook. And make sure you join us throughout the week as our podcasts drop and we go from one to the pitch to the other of the Gioca nel Mondo.